rival. My brothers were standoffish, embarrassed to be so different, but I was pleased. Justine had told me this was the best school on the island and promised me I would find my calling here. Our teachers were religious, dedicated people whose goal was to bring education to the new world, and they were tolerant of race and religion in ways that astounded and refreshed me. Even as a very young child, I did not approve of dictates and thought even less of those who enforced them, those who were our elders and called themselves our betters. These were the same people who spat on the street after my mother passed by. If I had not been born a rebel, if the treatment of my parents hadn't turned me into a radical, then I had been made one by the injustices I saw on our island. From the very start, I wondered about the meaning of freedom. My mother said I asked too many questions. "You look too deeply into things. Don't make trouble," she said. A laughable statement, considering all the trouble she'd made for our family, and how my father still had to remind her not to speak her mind in public, for she often held nothing back. Her tongue was sharp, and when she was angry, I avoided her as best I could. The truth was, I was happy not to be at the school at the synagogue, because I could escape the extra work of learning Hebrew and studying the Torah. At the Moravian school, we learned Bible stories as well, but they were about Jesus, who I had not heard of before, and of the possibilities of salvation despite our sins on earth. Such stories were interesting to me, and over the years I was in school, I paid careful attention to them. The idea that God would have a son on earth was particularly fascinating. It made God seem closer to humanity, more involved in our daily trials. I had struggled with the concept of a God that would let his people suffer and make the world we lived in so unequal, especially when I passed the shanty towns on my way to school, for it was a long walk, and I dawdled behind my brothers so I might take it all in. Was it fair that some people on this island should live in huge houses surrounded by courtyards filled with fruit trees while others lived in shacks? In the stories we were told, Jesus was an outcast and a rebel. He was a Jew who would not bow down to the Romans or to any authority other than God. I grew to admire him, something I would not have dared mention to my mother. I was not a believer in the Christian faith, merely an interested observer. I said Amen at the end of their prayers, then had pangs of guilt. I asked Mariana about this one day, and she shrugged. She told me her family practiced the old religion from Africa. "At school, you have to pretend you accept their faith. My family doesn't believe in such things. I just go along with these stories." In that instant, I saw that we were the same. Disbelievers surrounded by believers. Outcasts on an island where we were not equals, she less equal than I because of her color and sex. I felt a tightness in my throat due to this bond, and an understanding of the world that would stay with me all the rest of my life. I was 8 or 9 at the time, but later, I came to feel that this was my first moment of true love. To know and be known by someone. It did not hurt that Mariana was beautiful, more so as we got older. She had high cheekbones and was very dark, with light-filled eyes flecked with green. When she smiled, the world was something new to me. This is what I wished for, even as a boy. To see what was there, but also what was underneath flesh and blood, core and pit, leaf and stem. Above all else, despite my mother's warnings, I wished to see. I began to draw in class. I had no idea that I had any particular talent until people told me so. Other children gathered around and asked me to draw this or that. They flattered me and begged me for my art. Sometimes I complied, drawing their faces or the form of a donkey, but mostly I did as I pleased. I had always looked at the world as if it were a puzzle. Whether it was a scene, a landscape, or a person, the pieces dissolved inside my mind so that I then could put them back together to form a whole. This made sense when I began to draw, creating the elements one image at a time until the world appeared on the paper. Instead of going directly home, as my brothers did, I went to the beach and drew Mariana, using a bit of charcoal and some heavy paper I took from the storeroom at school. I drew Mariana so many times I knew her face better than my own. I felt I had come upon the core of the meaning of life, to discover and recreate beauty. We spent hours together, but after a while this stopped. Mariana's mother caught us together. She grabbed me and told me that if I bothered her daughter again, she would have me beaten. I doubted this, but Mariana was too afraid of misbehaving to see me anymore. We were only children, and Mariana was respectful. In many ways, she was more grown up than I. She told me she could no longer be my friend. I understood. My sisters were the same when it came to our mother's demands. They did as she said. They didn't want trouble. When Mariana could no longer spend time with me after school, I did not give up art. I drew the island around me, beginning with a palm tree. I sketched it section by section, leaf by leaf. I became the palm tree as I did this, knowing it inside out. The undersides of the leaves, which I did not draw, I still knew inside my head. I dreamed of whatever I drew. The palm fronds, a bat hanging from a tamarind tree, a woman walking down the street with a basket of laundry under her arm. I did not have much to do with my brothers and sisters. They were busy, the older ones working in the store, the younger ones interested in their studies. Sometimes I caught my mother studying me. She had a cautious expression at these times, as if I were a specimen she was studying under glass. When I was a young boy, they called me Marmotte, Sleepyhead. I could nap under the table with ease. My parents said they often found me dozing on a bench in the garden or on the beach while the other children played and swam. Now that I was older, I didn't sleep much. When I did, I dreamed of color, of blue mostly, in every shade, for our island is made up of the many delicate hues of that color. In the hottest months, I dreamed also of green. On those occasions, I awoke dizzy, as if I had slept in a field. I smelled wet grass, snarls of berries on vines, honey-scented flowers. And so it came to be that I carried these colors with me, awake or asleep. It didn't matter if I was in the classroom or in my parents' house. I was somewhere else as well. Inside blue, inside green, inside a palm tree. Inside Mariana's light-flecked eyes. Being an outcast meant I possessed a sort of freedom I wouldn't have had otherwise. And that was what I wanted from the time I could crawl. As a boy, I was a loner. There were days when no one knew where I was. I pinched paper and brushes from my father's store, then went into the hills and soon learned to make my own pigments from nature. Red petals, mud, clamshells, nutshells. I often used planks of wood as my canvases. I used a knife and created my images in slices. I learned much about dyes for my paints from Justine. As close as my mother was to Rosalie, Justine was the only person my mother truly confided in, though their relationship was a rocky one, with ups and downs I didn't understand. Sometimes when my mother came to visit, Justine would act as if she couldn't hear her at the door. This could go on for months. And then one day, Justine would embrace my mother as if she were a sister. Justine was a dressmaker, the best there was. I often went to her house at the harbor where she had vats of dye set out on the porch in a line of brilliant color. When one of the dresses she made was particularly beautiful, she would say, "This still isn't worthy of my daughter." She had no daughter, so I assumed that she hoped to have one someday, or perhaps it was just a saying. "Yes, it's beautiful enough," I would tell her, but she would always shake her head. "You don't know," she'd say. "You're too young." I found it much easier to talk to Justine than to my mother. I was closer to her and could talk to her about things my mother would never have understood. It was in our conversations that I first learned about color, how tint laid upon tint created a mist of a certain shade. Justine had told me never to rush something I was creating, but instead to let it come into being as if it had a soul of its own. It was so pleasant to be at Justine's house. My mother watched me like a hawk, as if waiting for bad traits to surface. She kept that hawk eye on me in a manner that made me want to run away from her. But Justine let me be. I loved my homeland, yet I wanted to leave. I walked alleyways lined with warehouses that led down to the harbor. The desire to travel was in my blood. I watched the boats depart from the wharves and wished I were on one. I didn't care what the destination was, South America, New York, Europe. I was willing to go anywhere, greedy for all the color in the world. I watched the reflections of clouds disappearing into the water, and thought that in another harbor the water might be an entirely different color, the sky a soft dove gray, the mountains forest green, the ice-cold waves a deep and endless indigo. Justine allowed me a glimpse of the person my mother once had been. I made a remark about how my mother understood nothing about the beauty of our world, that she was focused only on household chores and on my father. Justine told me I was wrong. She took me to a field where she said she and my mother used to go whenever they could run off from their chores. She said the only task my mother enjoyed was killing chickens for the Friday night dinner, a fact that made me laugh. There were blue snails climbing up the tamarind trees, and seawater cut through the field in a crisscross of salty, shallow pools. It was here, Justine said, they would lie in the grass without moving, except for breathing out and in, which moved the grass in waves like the sea. I couldn't imagine my mother as a girl, but I painted the grass and the red flowering trees and the gleam of the water in my next painting. I did my best to show the wind in blues and overlapping grays. Justine next took me to a stretch of beach where she said turtles came once a year to lay their eggs. It was the place where she and my mother would hide in the dark. They would pretend they were girls who were half turtle and imagine that they would swim away and never look back. The sky was midnight blue, one of the colors I loved to paint with, a shade I often dreamed of. I painted the beach and a palm tree that unfolded like a flower. In the shadows there were turtles, their shells a green-black from the depths of the sea. Then we went to stand outside the shop, beneath my mother's window. Justine said, "She fell in love looking outside onto this street." The street was yellow, with rose-colored blooms in the hedges. We went on through our section of town to the big house where my grandparents had lived, where the oldest lizard on the island hid in the courtyard. I remembered Rosalie's wedding and the garden aglow that night. My mother had come looking for me. She thought I'd disappeared to sleep in a quiet place, but I was crouched beside the bushes looking for the lizard. "My cousin used to do what you're doing. He could call the iguana to him. He was such a handsome boy." Perhaps my mother forgot she was speaking to me. She let slip that when she had come to her first husband's house, Rosalie had been a slave. She hadn't been aware of this until Monsieur Petit died and the will was read. The first thing my mother had done as a widow was to have papers drawn up for Rosalie's emancipation, but she had to wait for my father to come from France to sign those papers because a woman hadn't the legal right to do so. At Rosalie's wedding, 100 candles had been lit, and it seemed as if the stars had fallen from the sky. In bringing me back to that house, Justine reminded me of the moment when my mother and I stood in the garden. When I went home, I took out my paint and brushes and did my best to create the rooms inside my grandfather's house without ever having seen them. The walls were in tints of pistachio and salmon and pale gold. I practiced my art until I was ready to complete a real portrait. I chose to sketch Justine as she worked dyeing clothes, and then to paint that image. When I sketched her, I saw something in her face I hadn't noticed before. All at once, I saw that the color of grief was blue, and that it radiated from her. I painted her in that shade. Flesh tones didn't show the real substance of people, neither their physical aspects nor their souls. Since I'd begun the painting, I found I had difficulty sleeping. I thought about Justine's mention of a dress for her daughter and the color of sorrow, and my mother standing in the garden watching me, suspicious, as if I was her cousin from long ago. I thought of things I had overheard when my mother and Justine had no idea I was listening. I wasn't really paying attention, yet still I heard bits of conversation. How could a person be so selfish? How could love turn to ash? Why would God allow cruelty in the world if he truly were watching over his sons and his daughters? The next day I worked up enough courage to question my mother. I found her in the kitchen with Rosalie. They were discussing dinner, something they did nearly every day, and yet they seemed to find the subject endlessly fascinating. Would we have chicken or fish? Would the sauce be sweet or sour?
"Does Justine have a daughter?" I asked.
My mother and Rosalie exchanged a look. They kept cooking the Friday night meal, slamming around cast-iron pots. They had decided we would have chicken flavored with thyme and parsley and tomatoes, along with a cornmeal porridge and loaves of hot bread. My father would say the blessing over the meal, and then my brothers and I, starving by the end of the day, would grab for what we wanted until my mother clapped her hands and told us to be civilized. Usually, I would have tried to sneak a bit of the food that was being prepared, but on this day, I merely studied my mother, who was clearly upset by my question.
"You're a busybody,"
Rosalie told me in her matter-of-fact way. She was always protecting my mother, telling me to hush, saying I should keep my thoughts to myself. I didn't back down.
"She mentioned a daughter."
My mother shrugged. "She had one once," she admitted. I'd had my suspicions, yet was shocked to hear this news.
"And what happened to her?"
"Ask Justine," my mother suggested. I knew my mother. That was it. She turned her back and would say no more. The next time I saw Justine, I asked if it was true, if she'd had a daughter.
"It is true. Maybe you're too young to know about such things."
"I'm not," I told her. She fixed on me with her deep-set gray eyes as if searching for something. For a moment, I thought she might tell me to leave, but she didn't. She gestured to the sea.
"My daughter was stolen."
"Stolen? Who took her?" At that moment, I envisioned myself a hero jumping up to track down her missing child. I would swoop in to thwart the abductors and perhaps prove to my mother that I was worth more than she thought.
"Ask your mother who the thief is,"
Justine said with an odd sort of calm.
"She knows well enough."
I never liked to be between the two of them, and I had begun to realize whatever had happened was at the root of all their squabbles. I was afraid to say more to my mother. I feared she would clamp down on those few small freedoms I had. I secretly worked on my painting of Justine, keeping it in the back room of the store where there were barrels of grain and rice. I thought it was the best work I had yet done. Different than my other paintings, more layered and complicated, and yet simple in its emotion. One day I came for it and found it was gone. I was burning with rage. At least I knew who the thief was. There was only one person who continually told me that drawing and painting were a waste of my time. One person who shook her head as if I were doing something shameful when I leafed through illustrated books so that I might study the work of the great masters that I someday hoped to see for myself in the Louvre. My mother was in the garden where we had fruit trees, including an old twisted apple tree. The bark was black as a snakeskin. Sometimes Rosalie made a cake from the apples, adding herbs and spices. No matter what she did, any recipe made from the fruit of this tree was bitter, though my mother seemed to enjoy it. As I approached, my mother looked me up and down.
"You should be concentrating on your studies," she said before I had time to formulate a single word.
Perhaps she had seen the stain of dye on my shirt.
"I know what you've been doing," she informed me. "There's nothing wrong in what I do."
I could feel some shackle being thrown off. I didn't feel the fear I usually experienced when I talked back to her.
"In fact, there is," my mother said. "The way you paint doesn't look anything like this world. I worry that you have something wrong with your vision. You think this world is all there is?"
I was both insulted and embarrassed. The colors I used might not have been of this world. Instead, they showed what lay below the surface of this world, the spark of color at the deepest core.
If your eyes see everything, did they see who stole Justine's daughter? My mother lowered the basket of apples. I think she took in who I was for the first time, a person who would not easily bow to someone's command. Perhaps for the first time, I allowed my real self to be seen. A pelican flew overhead and cast its shadow upon us. All at once, my mother regained her composure. "That is none of your business," she said. "It's Justine's affair, no one else's." After that, my father told me I would work in the store on Sundays. I was perhaps 10 at the time and already knew I would rather be anywhere else. My older brothers all worked at the store, and I did the best I could, but I was easily bored by figures. When my inability to add was discovered, I was given the job of making certain the shelves were filled and dusted. Then I could easily take off into the storeroom. I pilfered a drawing pad, and though I felt guilty, I was delighted with my new possession, and used burned wood as charcoal for my sketches. One of my duties was to carry packages home for the ladies who shopped with us, and I enjoyed this, for it gave me back a bit of my independence. Sometimes the ladies presented me with a coin, which I saved up, hoping for a box of pastel chalks. Once I carried the groceries of a Madame Holovy, a very old woman who barely looked at me. She was a bit terrifying, like the old lizard in the garden of my grandfather's house. When we got to her home, a huge stucco mansion painted firefly yellow, she told me she wanted me to bring the packages inside. Then she demanded that I put the flour and molasses and ground sugar in the pantry, where such things were kept away from beetles and stinging ants. She had both an indoor and an outdoor kitchen, and I wondered if she was so rich she had two of everything. She sat at the table and studied me as I worked, calling out where the items should be placed. When I was done, she told me to sit across from her. I saw the folds in her skin, the white film over her pale eyes. I found all of this very interesting. One of her hands had a tremor she couldn't control, and I had the notion she might grab me and shake the life out of me there in the kitchen if she disapproved of anything I did or said. Yet I was more curious than I was frightened. She took off her thick white gloves. They were an old-fashioned accessory that only the very old ladies on the island kept to anymore. It was far too hot for gloves. I would have loved a glass of limeade, but I didn't ask for anything. "Would you like to know the truth about your family?" she asked. I made a face. "Truth is different things to different people." Frankly, I was parroting Justine, who had told me this. Madame Holovy laughed. "It's one thing when your mother sleeps with a nephew young enough to be her son, then marries him when the congregation denies the union, and yet another when she still thinks she's better than everyone." "Maybe she is." I might have been 10, but I was sly. My mother and I had our problems, but that was private. All the same, I was glad to be told information I had mostly guessed at before. Madame Holovy laughed again. I could tell she had taken a liking to me despite herself. "Would you like to come to our school and learn Hebrew?" she asked. I shrugged. "I'm not much of a student." "Well then, would you like to know what happened to Justine's daughter?" she asked. I was stunned by this offer, and it must have showed in my face. The old lady smiled. She had my interest now. I realized that other than her maid, who sometimes came to shop at our store, Madame lived alone. Her husband and children had passed on, aside from one daughter who I'd heard had gone to America. Perhaps she was lonely and wished to speak freely to someone. What danger was a 10-year-old child? "Come to tea tomorrow," she said. At dinner with my family that evening, I mentioned that I had carried Madame Holovy's groceries to her house. "That witch," my mother said. She spat on the floor. "She was a friend of your grandmother's," my father told me. Then when my mother shot him a look, he added, "Long ago." I saw my mother that night standing outside feeding a pelican that lived on Justine's roof, but sometimes came to our garden. I recognized the bird because it had a ruff of gray feathers around its throat. My mother gave it not merely fish bones, but an entire small fish, cooked and spiced. She talked to the bird as if it were human, conversing with it, though its only response was to stare back at her. "You agree with me," I heard her say to the bird. My mother was crouching down near the frangipani as though she were a girl. The sky was a soft, fragile blue. The air itself was tinted an inky shade as if there were drops of water in the veil that surrounded us. I could see my mother as Justine had described her, a girl who ran off into the countryside to look for turtles and birds, who intended to fly away or jump into the sea and be carried to another shore. I could not sleep that night and dreamed of shades of aquamarine and navy and indigo. All day, next day in school, I thought about whether or not I should return to Madame Holovy's house when I knew my mother wouldn't approve. Mariana and I still shared a desk, but next year I would have to share my desk with a boy. By then we would be considered too old to sit together innocently. I had the sense that soon enough this would be my long ago. At 3 o'clock, I went to Madame Holovy's and knocked at the back door, and the maid let me in. "She had me make banana cake for you," the maid said. She was nearly as old as Madame Holovy, and I knew that when she came into the store, my brothers made fun of how stooped she was. "I haven't made it in so long I forgot the recipe," the maid told me. "Eat it anyway so she won't yell at me." Madame was waiting for me in the dining room. It was an elegant room filled with antiques from France. Silver candlesticks, expensive china, a lace runner on the table. There were emerald green cut velvet chairs sent from France, and the rugs were hand-woven, spun of pale gold wool. The light coming in through the window was obscured by silk curtains and turned red as it filtered across the floor. "There you are," she said to me. "I thought you might come back. I'm a good judge of character." We had our tea, and I ate an entire slice of the nearly inedible cake to please the maid. The crumbs stuck in my throat, and I had to wash them down with cold ginger tea before I could speak. "You were going to tell me about Justine's daughter?" I reminded Madame. I thought she must be 80 or so, maybe 90. She wore 2 gold rings. "I was very close to your grandmother. She was a lovely person and the best friend I could have had, like a sister. The good deeds that she did have gone unknown. But she didn't get along with your mother. No one likes a headstrong girl who won't do as she's told. Your grandmother adopted a boy out of the kindness of her heart. She treated him like a son, and I suppose your mother resented that. Maybe this caused a rift between mother and daughter that was never healed. Or maybe it was because your mother always tried to get what she wanted by any means necessary, even if it would ruin her own children's lives." I ate another slice of the horrid banana cake and kept listening. I noticed the old madame's eyes were so pale they were like stones on the beach. I wondered if she could see through the white film. The angles of her face were sharp, planes in the shape of a bird's wing. Loss had cut into her and left a mark. I could see that she had once been strikingly beautiful. She had an entire book of stories inside her, waiting to be told, but she didn't give anything away without a cost. I knew she wanted something from me, though I couldn't imagine what that might be. After a while, she waved her hand, dismissing me. "Come back on Thursday, if you want to hear more." I thanked her formally, and she took my hand. She was strong when she held on to me. She wasn't quick to let go. "Tell your mother you were here. Ask her if she has anything to say to me." I was confused. Here were two women who clearly hated each other, and yet they were interested in one another's lives. When I returned home, I told my mother of my visit, simply to see her reaction. She was sitting with my sister Hannah, who was a grown woman and very close to my mother. When I told them where I'd been, Hannah and my mother exchanged a glance. My sister was of marriageable age, and I knew there was a young man she met late in the evening. I'd heard their voices in the small yard behind our store. There was some bitterness involved and some intrigue, for he came only at night, when no one knew he was there. I soon understood my sister was not considered good enough for his family.
"You visit Madame Halevy?"
My mother seemed genuinely shocked. It had been years since she'd had anything to do with people of our faith. On an island as small as ours, they had needed to try hard to avoid each other, but they had managed. The street could always be crossed, after all, when you saw someone you didn't wish to greet.
"She wants to know if you have anything to say to her?"
I was a calm, detached messenger, but inwardly excited to annoy my mother. I felt the drama of the situation and believed that for once I had the upper hand. I noticed that Hannah tugged on my mother's arm, urging her to give me an answer.
"Tell her she's a witch," my mother said.
The very next day, Hannah was waiting for me when I was let out of school in the afternoon. We walked together for a while. The sea was aquamarine, the sun so bright we squinted just to see. The world was light and white. We'd had different parents, but she was the sister I felt closest to. She was tall, with blue eyes and pale red hair. Anyone could tell Hannah wasn't directly related to my mother. She had a sweet nature that was to be found nowhere else in our family.
"When you go to see Madame, tell her our mother sends her best regards and asks for her forgiveness."
I was many things, but not a liar.
"Hannah," I said, "our mother would have my hide if I said that, and I doubt that Madame Halevy would believe me."
My sister explained that she wished to be wed to a man from the congregation whom she'd met when he came to our store. But since my mother and father's marriage was still such a sore point, this man could not tell his family of his love for her. We were outcasts, and he was an upstanding member of the community. He was a cousin of Madame Halevy, and her good wishes could change everything if she was inclined to help. Hannah was flushed as she talked to me. I realized she was beyond the age most girls were when they married. She was animated as she spoke, her pale skin flushed with heat, and with something I was too young to recognize as desire. I saw there was a blue thread in the yellow dress she wore, a ribbon that was nearly invisible to the naked eye. I worked in the store that day, beside my three brothers who were better at any task than I was. At the end of the day, I took a bottle of rum, wrapped it in burlap, and put it into my school bag. I had recently turned 11, and after that birthday, my father had sat down with me for a talk. He wanted me to learn Hebrew so that I might be bar mitzvah when I turned 13. He told me the synagogue would not be able to deny me this, but I thought they likely would, and I had no interest in my lessons, other than the fact that the teacher he had found for me, a Mr. Lieber, was an affable, learned man from Amsterdam who told me stories I enjoyed hearing. He spoke of skating on the canals, but more interesting to me was the color of his childhood world, for it was incandescent and white, with snow falling everywhere, onto the frozen river, onto his eyelashes. I thought about the many shades of white there might be, white with cold blue, and white with gold, and silver white falling from the night sky. I learned some Hebrew from Mr. Lieber, but all in all, despite my father's good intentions, I was a terrible student. I went for my lesson on the day I was to visit Madame Halevy, but as usual, I wasn't prepared. "I notice you don't study," Mr. Lieber said to me. "If you did, it might change things."
"I'm a bad student."
Lieber shook his head. "You're a disinterested student." I presented Mr. Lieber with the bottle of rum I'd taken from the store and asked if I might skip my lessons from now on. I would instead stop by, say hello, then be on my way, ready to wander into the mountains with my sketch pad or, something I failed to mention, sit in Madame Holovy's dining room and listen to her stories. "And what do I tell your father?" Mr. Lieber asked me. "Tell him I'm a work in progress," I suggested. "Is there anything you care about?" he asked me. It was a difficult question, but I knew the answer. I cared about light, color, bone structure, the movement of the leaves on the lime trees, the luminous scales of fish in the harbor. I did not know how to explain this, so I said, "There is, but it's not in any book." "At least you're honest," he said to me. We shook hands, he accepted the rum, and then I went to Madame Holovy's. The more she refused to tell me the story of Justine's daughter, the more I wanted to hear it. I think I was obsessed. I loved Justine and could not stand to think of her in pain. It was as if the mystery of the world would be revealed to me once I understood what had happened to this girl. The maid had prepared a mango pastry that was syrupy and brought flies to it. "Here's our little guest," she said when I walked through the door. I was as tall as she, so I laughed. I had inherited my father's height and was the tallest fellow in my classroom, as well as the laziest when it came to my studies. I went to sit at the dining room table. The lace runner from Burgundy was set over the gleaming mahogany. I saw now it was frayed, thin as tissue. Upon inspection, I realized the silverware was twisted and very old, brought from France 2 generations ago. Some of it had turned black due to the salt air. Everything that had been new and beautiful was ancient now. The island's weather was not good for preserving delicate things. Madame Holovy came in to greet me. "Your mother has a message for me?" "She does indeed." I still wasn't sure of what my response would be. Madame seemed to like the pastry her maid had concocted. She dug right in. So I pretended to eat, to be polite. Mostly, I pushed the crust around my plate. The pastry was pale and flaky, the color of damp sand. I decided to give Madame Holovy the message constructed by my sister. "My mother sends you her best wishes and asks that you forgive her all of her transgressions."
"Does she?"
Madame Holovy said thoughtfully. Her eyes were bright beneath the white film that covered them. I could see the intelligence in her expression. I didn't think for a minute that she believed me.
"How is your sister Hannah?"
she asked. She was cagey at all times. "Fine," I nodded. "Ready to get married?" I wasn't certain if I should speak of this or not, so I concentrated on my tea. The china was from Paris, golden green, bone thin. I added sugar, and then, as people on our island did, a dash of molasses. It made a very sweet and delicious mixture.
"Married properly in the synagogue?"
Madame Holovy asked.
"That is her wish," I said. "What your parents did tore apart the community. We are too few, and we as a people have suffered at the hands of too many to fight among ourselves like chickens."
I remembered something Justine had told me.
"My mother used to kill chickens on Fridays when she was a girl. She said she enjoyed it."
Madame Holovy laughed grimly.
"I'm not surprised. Enough for today. I will take your sister's wish into consideration." "What about Justine's daughter?"
She seemed to have forgotten her promise to tell me the story.
"Tell your mother I accept her apology. I invite her and your father for dinner next Friday night. Hannah can come with them. We'll all go to services first. Come back after that happens, and I'll tell you the story."
In order to hear the end of the story, I had to accomplish a task I thought might be impossible. I had to convince people who hadn't spoken to each other in over 10 years to take up polite conversation across the dinner table. It felt like a Herculean undertaking. I thought about my father praying in the garden alone. He was a good man, and sometimes he went past the synagogue at night and prayed at the doorstep. I wondered if my mother had placed some sort of spell on him that bound him to her. If I ever pledged myself to a woman, she would need to have a kind and open heart and understand there was another way of seeing the world beyond the rules we had been taught. I stopped in the kitchen on my way out of Madame's house. The maid was still there, preparing dinner. She had made loaves of cassava bread that smelled heavenly. Her name was Helena James, she told me, and now that I seemed to be a fixture in the house, we should know one another. We shook hands solemnly. We were the only two people Madame had in her home. She went to services and to meetings of the sisterhood, but she liked to be alone in her house. However, Mrs. James told me that her employer looked forward to my visits. Madame had lost two children to fevers, and a third had left for Charleston and was rarely heard from. Her daughter had an entire family in America whom Madame Halevy had never met. I stayed for a while and sketched Mrs. James as she diced vegetables and fruit with a sharp paring knife. Mrs. James favored mangoes because they brought good health. She informed me that a person could live on mangoes alone, and that the pirates used to do exactly that for months on end. Mrs. James was not a great cook, far from it, but her cassava bread was a miracle. I would be happy to have her bread for every meal. I enjoyed her unruffled manner, and the fact that she liked to talk. When I idly brought up Justine, not imagining I would have any more information from the maid than I'd had from Madame Halevy, Mrs. James shook her head sadly. I don't talk about bad luck. Best forgotten about. I don't believe in luck, I said. Mrs. James laughed and said, You're too young to know what you believe. She looked to make sure that we were indeed alone in the kitchen and wouldn't be overheard.
Abduction,
Mrs. James whispered to me then. It sounded like a religious act. I thought it was perhaps a practice at the church or one of the African meeting houses. I rolled that word around inside my head all that day. When I next went to Mr. Lieber's to drop by so it would appear I was studying, he was napping. I took the opportunity to look through his library. I found the word in a small leather-bound dictionary. Capture. Abduction. Enlèvement. It was as Justine had told me. Her daughter had been stolen. Hannah had to direct me on how best to renew relations between our mother and her old enemy. I went to speak to my parents after dinner. They were sitting in the parlor on a settee close to each other, deep in conversation. My mother had her hand inside my father's sleeve. It was as if she was a vine encircling his arm beneath the white linen. It was an oddly intimate gesture, one that made me uncomfortable for reasons I didn't understand. From the doorway, they looked like the lovers I sometimes spied by the harbor who were so intent on each other, they seemed to have forgotten there was a world outside themselves. I saw a smile on my mother's face that surprised me. As soon as I stumbled near, she looked up. The smile quickly disappeared.
Don't you announce yourself, she said to me. You move the way thieves do.
I have an invitation, I declared. Friday night dinner at Madame Halevy's.
My voice sounded unsure, perhaps because of my mother's darkening expression.
Did I hear you correctly? She asked.
After services, I said. The two of you and Hannah.
We're not welcome at services, my mother said.
And who asked you to interfere?
You'll be welcome, I said, enjoying the power of knowing more than my mother.
Fine.
My father seemed pleased.
We accept. We'll come to dinner. After services.
On the following Friday, my sister took an hour to dress. I could hear conversation blooming down the hall as Rosalie helped her get ready. They laughed and talked about hats and shoes. My parents seemed nervous. In fact, they'd been quiet all that day, exchanging glances. I heard my father say, "What more can they do to us? Perhaps the time has come to move forward."
That time came and went,
my mother responded. I wondered if whatever had happened in the synagogue was the seed of her bitterness. The shadows around her appeared green, lengthening along the mosaic floor as the hour grew later and the time for her to return to the congregation approached. For an instant, I saw her as she must have been when she was young and unsure of herself. Her familiar features shifted and seemed vulnerable and unformed. I had the sense I was looking straight through time. Later, I studied myself in a dim, silvered mirror. I don't like to think I resembled her, but our eyes were the same, dark and filled with defiance. I went to the synagogue for the first time that night. I had never walked inside before, only peeked in, and now I was stunned by how beautiful it was. A sort of hush stirred within me, and I thought about God abiding in a place, listening to the prayers that were sent to him. I wore a black suit and white shirt borrowed from one of my brothers. Everything was too big, so my father nodded for me to tuck in the tails of the shirt. "I hope you learned your Hebrew," he joked. I hadn't, and I was forced to mumble along when prayers were said. My father and I stood with the men, while Hannah and my mother remained with the women. I caught a glimpse of Madame Halevy. She wore a lace shawl and a plum-colored dress. She raised her eyes to me, and a message flickered across her face. I had done well to bring my parents here, and she was pleased. My mother narrowed her eyes and gazed at me, and I quickly looked away from the women. I stared straight ahead to the altar in the center of the room. Despite my mother's questioning look, I felt oddly pleased to have assisted Madame Halevy. When we left, people stared at us. A few men came to my father and shook his hand. With their greeting, my family was accepted back into the congregation. My mother held her tongue and merely nodded to the women who had ignored her for so long. I hadn't been invited to join the adults for dinner. Instead, I sat in the kitchen with Helena James. Mrs. James had made a chicken dumpling stew, the wonderful cassava bread, and the terrible mango pastry. "Madame's favorite," she said. She told me she had been working for Madame Halevy for almost 50 years. She had helped her raise her children, and they'd all loved mango pastry. "Just like you," she said. I ate everything on my plate, of course. I could hear voices rise and fall in the dining room. I waited for an argument and my mother's sharp tone of anger, but heard nothing. I must have fallen asleep with my head on the kitchen table. All at once it was late. My parents were leaving, and Hannah was embraced by Madame Halevy, who called her a most charming guest. That evening was the end of our shunning as the cloud cast over my family evaporated into mist. After that time, no one mentioned the scandal and the years when no one would speak to us. I believe that after that night, letters were sent to the king's court and to the rabbi in Denmark, withdrawing any complaint against my parents. Customers now spoke with us as if we were part of their family. Every once in a while, my mother looked at me as if trying to figure me out. How had I accomplished this fragile peace after so many years of war between her and everyone else of our faith? She pursed her lips and seemed to wonder who I was. But that was nothing new, and I went my own way. I had several friends at school now, boys who had to work in the fields after classes or fished alongside their brothers. I went out on skiffs with them sometimes, but they called me lazy because I wanted to sketch them as they worked rather than join in the fishing. My closest friends were Peter and Elijah, two brothers, one older than I was and one a year younger. In order to join in, I learned how to fish and how to clean the catch. I got to know the water and saw its many layers. The sea creatures floating below us, pale gold and red fish, moss-green seaweed, shells that glowed like opals, fire, stars dropped into the sea. I began to look at working people in a different way, and took to sketching them as they labored. In a matter of weeks, Hannah had her proposal, and my father began to attend services at the synagogue regularly in the mornings and on Friday nights. The family went to services every Friday night as well. I often skipped out and took the opportunity I was afforded of having these nights to myself. I went to the harbor to sketch, and even made some money when sailors wanted their portraits made. In the evenings, my father still said his prayers in our garden, privately and alone. I could hear his blessings rise up through my window. He was still in his 30s then, still a young man, serious, interested in the world around us. He liked to talk to working people and appreciated them as I did. When we walked together, he would ask questions about the simplest things, for he hadn't grown up on this island, and every bird and flower interested him as they interested me. I felt closer to him as I grew older, and I think he felt close to me. He often spoke to me as if I were a friend as well as a son. He said that when he came to this island, he had been bewitched. He laughed when he said this, but he still seemed mystified by the turns his life had taken. I told him then of my interest in sketching and painting. When I said color was everything, he nodded, agreeing. He remembered his first glimpse of the turquoise sea, the red hillsides, the flocks of brilliant birds. Once we took a vine of bougainvillea and removed every bloom, twisting them carefully and laying them out upon the ground to study the varying shades of scarlet and pink. On another night, as we walked along the wharves to check on a shipment to the store, he told me that he and my mother often had the same dream. I could see that this was part of the enchantment he'd spoken of. I continued to bring Madame Halevy her groceries, still waiting for the story she'd promised to tell, but somehow always managed to avoid. Sometimes I would run into Mariana on the street. She would laugh when she saw me carrying the sacks of flour and bags of vegetables. "You're going to the mean old lady's house? Why do you do this? You're not her servant." I couldn't explain. Perhaps I'd simply gotten used to going to Madame's huge stucco house. It was in disrepair, and she had no sons to shore up the walls and roof, and no money for servants other than Mrs. James. Still, I went. I appreciated the way the shadows drifted across her garden, falling through illuminated bands of yellow light, and admired her home, the old dishes on her table, the peonies she raised in her garden, apricot and pink, some as big as plates. I found the tilt of Mrs. James's head pleasing as she chopped up onions and mint. And perhaps more than anything, I liked the way Madame Halevy and Mrs. James admired my abilities. Both old ladies applauded when I could fix even the simplest thing. Many times I took up a hammer and nails and did the best I could to repair the shutters or the porch. During one of my visits, I found a small portrait of a girl on a shelf. A blue-eyed child I assumed was the daughter who lived in Charleston. For some reason, I knew not to ask about her. I'd come to understand that Madame Halevy would tell me her stories in her own time. One day she surprised me. Instead of waiting for my visit, Madame came to me. When I left work, she was waiting outside the store. In the full sunlight, I saw how ancient she was, surely more than 90 years on Earth. I saw, too, how frail she was. I could nearly spy her heart beating with the strain of having walked uphill to the store. Mr. Enrique carted out a metal chair for her, since she was clearly exhausted. "I would have brought you your groceries," I told her. It was noon, and the heat of the day was upon us. Madame Halevy gave me some money and asked me to purchase molasses and sugar. A few other things, some mint, some nuts, not much. She wanted Helena James to make a special cake for the next time I visited. "Walk me home," she said when I had finished her shopping and returned with her purchases. We went slowly and in silence, but soon she began to talk. "The worst that can happen is that you lose a child. My younger son was about your age when I lost him from yellow fever. He was 12. I was happy that she thought I was older than I was. My other boy was 14. I lost him the next season. I covered every window. I wouldn't let him go outside, but somehow the fever followed him into his room. She lowered her voice. It was fate, she said. I couldn't fight it.
And your daughter? I said.
She's alive, Madame said. That's all one can ask for. And yet all the while I'd known her, she had not received a single letter from Charleston. Though I posted the ones she wrote to her daughter, there had been no reply. Several times I'd had the urge to tear open one of the letters Madame Holloway wrote and see what she had to say to her daughter in America, but I didn't have the heart to do so. Your grandmother lost a baby boy, she told me now. You can't know what that does to a person. He was born and died in the same day. I know because I was there. I was her friend, and I watched her cry. It brought her some solace to take in a baby who had been abandoned. She raised him, and loved him as her own. Your grandmother did everything for him. She could not have done more. Unfortunately, the ending was not as anyone would have wished. You want to think the best of your child, so you look the other way when you see failures. Maybe it was because she spoiled him. He squandered vast sums from the business. Part of it was bad judgment. I believe he gambled. Do you ever go to see the cockfights? The fights occurred every night and every weekend, and I'd been to several. I'd stood in the background with my friends from school as their fathers and brothers bet on which rooster would live and which would die. Once blood splashed over my shoes, and I could feel how hot it was and how hot the men's tempers were. I knew Madame would disapprove.
I've heard of them, I said.
She laughed.
Yes, I'm sure.
She really could see right through me.
Well, the son of my dear friend was a darling boy, but he had been cast away as an infant, and perhaps that abandonment left its mark. I told her to be stricter, but she had a tender heart when it came to this boy. I'm telling you this because he was the father of Justine's daughter. He was in love with Justine, but he couldn't go against his mother, and she said they couldn't marry. Justine was not a member of the faith he'd been raised in. But that didn't stop him from making a child with her. You understand me?
I nodded. I knew as much about sex as any 11-year-old boy. Perhaps a bit more, because my friend Elijah had given me some of the details.
The affair was a mistake, Madame continued. But when you make a mistake, you take care of it. You take responsibility. Don't you agree?
I mumbled that I did, so she went on.
He left, and that would have been the end of it, but he came back. He and his wife were childless. They're the ones who took Justine's daughter.
You can't just take someone, I said. That's theft.
You are 12, Madame replied.
Again, I didn't correct her.
Do you know that women have few rights? And African people even fewer? People are stolen every day, dear boy. And there are those of us who feel she was taken to a better life.
The heat was strong, and my companion faltered as we went on, though she had her cane. She had to lean against a building we passed. After that, we stopped every once in a while so that Madame Holloway could rest. When she was quite tired, she sat on a stone wall beside an orchard. There were some parrots that she pointed out to me, slashes of bright green and scarlet among the leaves.
When I was a girl, there were hundreds of them, she said. You probably guess that I'm 100 years old myself and that I can't even remember being young. Do you think you'll get old? She asked me.
I'll probably die before I do, in a fight or a fall. I saw myself as a hero, not as an old man with a long beard.
Maybe on a boat, or in the mountains.
Unlikely.
No. You'll be an old man who has to sit on a stone wall. And when you do, you'll think of me.
When we reached the old mansion, I asked Madame where Justine's daughter had been taken.
Paris, if she's still alive.
It's been years. You lose people sometimes, you know? You don't expect to, but then it happens, and you can't get them back.
We went into the kitchen where Mrs. James took the groceries from us and asked Madame Holovey what on earth she was thinking